Good afternoon. So, hopefully you're here for operating systems. I'm going to start out by going over a bit of logistics, and then I'm going to go into talking about what an operating system is and about a little about system calls. So first, on our tour of logistics, the course has a web page. It's linked off Colab, so you don't need to frantically copy down this URL. Find it in Colab. That's where all information about assignments, schedule, and so on is. We will have homework assignments, which will be 55% of the grade, so they're actually very important. The first is due next Friday. Most of the homework assignments will be in C or C++, so I understand it's been a while for some of you since you've seen those programming languages, so to brush up a little. There'll be one in Python near the end. The programming assignments will generally will give you 1 or 2 weeks. If it's 2 weeks, there will be a checkpoint submission about halfway in the middle. And the two-week assignments will be worth more, partly because we expect you to spend more time on them, so please actually budget to spend more time on them. Some of the assignments will use a teaching operating system called XV6. This is based on an old Unix version built by some people at MIT. History was they previously used a real old Unix version, and then sometime in the 90s decided that maybe they shouldn't be using something that uses a type of computer that you can't buy anymore. So it's a rewrite of that old Unix version for 32-bit x86 that supports multi-core, could theoretically boot on real x86 hardware, but we're running it in an emulator to make things like reasonable to develop. In addition to homeworks, we will have quizzes. There will be online quizzes after each week of lecture covering things we went over in lecture that week. It's the same interface as 3330 if you've taken 3330 with me. If not, we'll go over it on Thursday. First quiz will be due next Tuesday. They're open book, open notes, open internet. So they're intended to get you to actually review the material and not just forget about it or not even attend lecture in any way and forget about it and not remember it in the first place. We'll also have a midterm and a final. Dates are on the schedule, and I hope not to change them. The final is a combined final with the other section at 7 p.m. It is not during the normal time. Please let us know at some point if you can't make either of those. And we'll talk about it. In particular, there's a slight possibility you have a final for a different course at the same time. Let us know if that's the case. Figure something out. There's a late policy. It's on the website. I'm not going to go over it. You can read it if it applies to you. We have textbooks. There are a recommended textbook, which is Anderson Dahlin, Operating Systems, Principles, and Practice. There's no required textbook, and there's also a suggested textbook, Operating Systems 3D PCs by husband and wife Arpeggio Dassù. This is be available as free PDFs from the author if you don't like having hard copy books and you want something cheap. I recommend Anderson Dahlin because I find it less terse for some of the things we're covering over it, but they both go through most of the same material, just in slightly different ways. And as I said, there's no required textbook. You could also look at Silver Shirts if you know someone who took this course a while ago, or just have a copy lying around for a different perspective. I probably should go over academic honesty. Homeworks are individual assignments. This means you shouldn't use code from prior semesters, except maybe your own code from prior semesters. You should not share code, pseudocode, detailed descriptions of code, or other things where I'm going to look at your two pieces of code and say, how could you have possibly written this without talking to each other about this code very, very specifically? Or sharing the code, copying and pasting, etc. Please don't use code from the internet, you know, books in the library, etc., with limited exception. So if it's solving things which are not the main point of the assignment, so for example, if you need to split a string into an array and the assignment is not mostly about text parsing, yeah, go ahead, do that. Like, this is not a course about, you know, how you split strings into arrays, But if you do so, please actually cite it in the code. So if it's clearly not part of the assignment, that sort of thing, it's fine. Make sure you cite where you got it in the code. So when I read your code and I see this function that's clearly in a different style, I know what happened. And as I said, it should not be the main point of the assignment. It should be something clearly ancillary, like I need to make an array of these strings. I need to turn these pointers into vectors or vice versa. That sort of like common task that's not specific to what we're having you do. If it's part of the major objective assignment, don't do it. If you have questions on what counts, please ask us first. In particular, like, even if you're only using the split string code, like, please do not look for a shell for the shell assignment to find that code. It's not acceptable. On the quizzes. Quizzes are also individual. They're open book, open notes, but please do not share answers with each other. Please don't IM people for answers. Please don't copy the quiz question onto Stack Overflow or something like that. We still want you to do them individually. And as a last piece of, those logistics, if you're waitlisted, if you need this course this semester to graduate on time, email me with specifics, and if you're on the waitlist, and I will figure something out. When you do so, please indicate which sections you are able to attend. If it's not both of them, you should please explain why, not just tell me, I prefer the other section, or else I'll assume that that's just a preference and not an actual requirement. On getting help, you can use Piazza. Someone should respond at some point there. We'll have office hours. I have office hours that are tentative because I might need to schedule a meeting around them, but posted, I'll try to finalize those soon, and RTA should have lots of office hours posted soon for help on assignments, etc. And you can also email me as a last option for questions. So any questions about logistics? Yes.
Can you attend either lecture?
Can you attend either lecture? I do not intend to check your lecture attendance in any way, except that you may not take the midterm or final midterm in the wrong lecture, please, because we'll run out of seats. Other questions? Yeah. Are the lectures recorded? They should be recorded. I do not guarantee that something won't go wrong with my recording setup, but I will attempt to record them. Other questions? Okay, so our first topic is going to be what a computer operating system is. And to talk about that, we'll start with sort of an idea. Well, computer operating systems, like many programs, are trying to automate something that you might do manually. So historically, there was a job of a computer operator where you had all your tapes storing your equivalent of files and programs, and you needed someone to like load them into the appropriate place and press the controls in the computer to make it start the program and so on. Like this manual-ish job, that someone had to do physically to coordinate all the programs and files and so on. And now we've automated it, and we have an operating system that does it for us. Now, I'm going to talk about what an operating system is, but we're not going to be very precise. And the reason we're not going to be very precise is because the world is not very precise of what they consider an operating system. They're clear that it's about automating these tasks of like loading programs, running programs, getting programs to their input and output, things like that, but the boundary is not well defined. In particular, you'll find some people will say that something is part of the OS, and some people will say, oh, that's just a library, or that's just a program. It's not really part of the OS. And this might include things like, say, the code which allows me to move windows on my screen. Some people will say, that's part of the OS. This operating system allows you to move windows on your screen. It's part of running multiple programs. Some people might say, well, that's just a program that's running on that you're running that lets you arrange windows. Just happened to be pre-installed, but just a program, it's not part of the OS. And we're not going to take a view on which one of these is more right or the other. I'm just going to tell you that it's a fuzzy line. We're mostly going to deal with things which are most people consider really the operating system and not sweat these details. So our vague definitions, which you can ask these questions about, I'm going to use from both the two primary textbooks. So Anderson Dahlin says, operating system is software that manages a computer's resources. So resources would be things like the processors, the cores, the memory, the I/O devices like hard drives with storage, networking, and so on. Operating system is software that manages that, whatever managing it means. And we'll talk about what Anderson Dahlin gives as examples of managing more specifically. Arpège Desault has this different view, and they say that the operating system provides a virtual machine that is more convenient than real hardware. And you might have some complaints. Wait. Virtual machine. I know what a virtual machine is. That's like VirtualBox, VMware. That doesn't make sense. We'll go over that in a bit. First, to start with, managing resources. What type of management do we expect? And Anderson Dahlin gives this sort of little taxonomy, which is kind of useful. And they say there's a sort of three types of management-like responsibilities that an OS does. So one is this role of a referee, that there are multiple applications trying to use these resources, and the OS needs to arbitrate between them, rather sharing to provide protection so one application doesn't interfere with another. So protecting applications from each other, protecting the OS from applications, and so on. And isolation, that applications shouldn't need to care about what else is happening on the machine if they don't want to. They also talk about this role of an illusionist, that hardware is really messy and changes a lot. And we like it to be the case that we provide a nicer interface than hardware provides. So for example, I can take old programs for Unix and run them basically unchanged on a modern system and have them display things to my screen. The way things get displayed to my screen on a 2019 computer is rather different than the way they were displayed to the screen in a 1990 computer. But that doesn't matter because we have this clean abstraction that didn't need to change, that can accommodate all those differences in the real machines. Operating system also provides sort of common services, things that are built on top of those resources that all the applications or many of the applications need, say access to storage and organizing that storage, windowing systems, letting people log in, and so on. And all this management, we can think of that the OS is abstracting away the hardware. So we can view this as we have our applications, which are running on top of the operating system, conceptually, which is running on top of the hardware. Now this is a logical view, because as we'll learn, it really is the case that there are times when the application's code is really directly talking to the hardware. But conceptually, we can imagine that all the application really knows about is what the operating system selects for it to know about. And applications are written for an operating system, not for a particular set of hardware. So this abstraction allows those roles of referee and illusionist and those common services to be provided to all the applications, to be neutral to the hardware. And also sort of motivates the other view I talked about, that virtual machine view, that if the operating system is all these applications know about, we can say that, our applications speak to the operating system using an interface, which we'll call a virtual machine interface. And our operating system speaks to the hardware with a physical machine interface. In this view, the important question is, what do we choose for that virtual machine interface? And there's a spectrum of choices. And you may have traditionally considered, oh, a virtual machine, it's like VirtualBox, VMware. Well, those are choosing what we know as a system virtual machine choice, that the interface they're providing to their applications is an interface that looks like physical hardware. It might not look like the physical hardware they're actually running on, but it looks like some physical hardware. They've chosen physical hardware and try to imitate that. But operating systems provide what we'll call a process virtual machine, where they've chosen things which don't look like any real hardware, but are more convenient for applications. So for example, the process virtual machine is going to provide files rather than a hard drive. So in VMware VirtualBox, you have a virtual hard drive, which is just a blob of data that whenever you're running on VirtualBox or whatever your virtual machine monitor is, needs to know about. Whereas when we're running in the process virtual machine model, we have files with names, we can make many of them. That's all provided, even though that doesn't really reflect what the hardware supports natively. This is just some more convenient interface that the operating system has chosen to make it easier to write applications that are useful. Okay. So we have our system virtual machines and our process virtual machines. So questions on this idea of process and system virtual machines? So we talk about process virtual machines, and we're going to talk about the most common sort of pattern for what we've chosen as that process virtual machine interface. And we have some particular abstractions which come up in many, many operating systems. And we can think of them as correlating directly to pieces of real hardware. So we have threads, and we can think of threads as sort of a virtual processor core. Oh. So each thread kind of represents a core, but it's an abstraction, so we don't need to implement it exactly the way the physical processor works. For example, if I have a four-core machine, it can have four processors, basically. If I have threads, the operating system can support more threads than I have processors. And its abstraction is going to be that it's going to hide that, well, we might not have enough actual processors to make that work directly. So we're going to do some extra work so you don't have to worry about how many cores do I really have. But threads are exposing the notion of a processor core to applications. We have memory allocation interfaces, something like malloc and things like that, which expose the idea that programs can get memory allocated to them. But in the hardware, we have some other implementation of that. And as we'll learn, the typical thing the hardware is going to provide is page tables, where the hardware has a certain amount of actual memory and the allocation is assigning addresses to that. So these memory allocation functions are how we make changes to these page tables for our application to use memory. What are files? And by files, I mean the open, read, and write, and close interface. You've probably used that. You might think of this as just referring to files that like you store on a hard drive or a USB stick. We're going to use the term more generically. This is going to be anything which represents not only things that you store, but like consoles, things that you get user input from, type 2 and print it out, network connections, and so on. We'll have this common file interface where you open up the file somehow, and then you can read from it or write to it. And this is going to represent all sorts of devices. And this is a nice abstraction because, well, the way the underlying devices work might be very different. The way that reading from the network works versus reading from the keyboard versus reading from a hard drive is all going to be very different as far as what you have to do to talk to the hardware, what sorts of units you can actually read. But we're going to provide one common interface where you just call a read function and it works. And the OS figures out how to make that deal with the particular kind of device you're working with. Okay. Some questions on these abstractions here. So I said we had a process virtual machine. So what is a process? And for this class, a process is sort of our abstraction for an application and its environment. And it's minimally going to consist of one or more threads. And remember, threads are sort of virtual cores, so this illusion of a dedicated CPU core, and an address space, which is going to be the illusion of a dedicated memory. So the address space, talk about that later. Okay, so the address space is going to be this illusion of a dedicated memory. We'll talk about how that works a little bit later, and in a lot of detail in several weeks into the semester. And we also might have some other things. So some examples are open files, and maybe there's a bunch more things that we're going to want eventually to represent stuff an application is using. But this is our process notion. This is the sort of key abstraction our operating system is going to provide. So when we get that together, we have our applications, which have their process virtual machine interface, which has, as we see, threads, address spaces, files, and so on. And we have our operating system, which is going to use a different set of interfaces and abstractions, some of which we'll talk about later in the semester, to talk to the actual hardware where we have a processors, memory, devices, and so on. And we've said that we have this virtual machine notion because the processes machine is the operating system. And in this model, the operating system's job is just translating one interface to another. It's not really making decisions about things other than how does threads map to these things and how do files map to these hardware interfaces. So one example of this is, let's say we're running an application. An application is going to be represented by a process abstraction. And since our process is running a thread is this virtual CPU core we talked about. And part of the important part for the program is that we have registers, including the program counter, as well as like a stack pointer and so on. And when application one is running, the operating system is going to implement this by actually putting the application on the real hardware core. And of course, the process also has memory associated with it, its address space. And when it's running, the operating system is going to implement that by actually assigning part of the real memory to the program. But this process abstraction is more powerful than sort of just talking to the CPU directly or the memory directly in the sense that, well, we can have two applications. And this is going to be fine even though we only have one CPU core here. So application two has its own process, and it has its registers. And in the physical hardware, well, we don't have room for two sets of registers on our CPU cores in this case, but that's okay. The operating system can implement that thread by temporarily putting the registers in memory. And this process has its own memory. The operating system is going to implement it by giving it a different part of the overall memory. So they both seem to have their own memory, but that's just by subdividing the real memory. And of course, This like lets us represent the process that's not running right now, but we need to run it eventually. And when it's actually running, it needs to be using the real core. So what we're going to do for that is we're going to swap the two roles. That we're going to have application 2, we're going to copy its registers over to the real CPU, and stash application 1's registers over in the memory. So this is how we have our sort of process abstraction with the thread. Here in this case, one thread. It's because we only have one set of registers, therefore one program counter, one stack pointer, so on. And it's address space. Applications are also going to have files. And so we'll have a whole bunch of files that we can access. And they'll map variously to all the types of devices that the operating system can use. And the operating system's responsible for figuring out, based on which file's being accessed, how to actually talk to the physical device. We also have another thing the operating system is responsible for, which didn't come up very directly talked about. And that's, well, what happens when applications do something strange? So let's say application 1 tries to access some memory that wasn't really assigned to it. The operating system is going to provide the convenient abstraction of turning that into a segmentation fault or something similar. You might say, segmentation fault, that's not really convenient, but it's probably more convenient than what the hardware would do naturally, in that the hardware might naturally like mess up some other code silently or break some other program. Instead, we've turned that into one thing, which is just that we can crash the program cleanly. Just a cleaner interface than our real hardware has for its direct memory access. And this gets us to a big responsibility of operating systems, and a big reason why we just sort of don't accept having, you know, not running an operating system that's reasonably fully featured, and this is to provide protection. By protection, I mean I want to run multiple applications, and I want to protect them from each other and from the OS. This means, for example, I want to keep them from crashing the OS. I want to keep them from crashing each other. I might also want to handle, you know, also keep from interfering in other ways. For example, we don't want an application to edit files it's not supposed to. That's another goal here. But first thing we'll worry about is like don't crash things, don't accidentally break things. But we also are often concerned about what if the program is like trying to mess other things up? Can we also prevent that? And most recent operating systems, almost all recent operating systems, use two pieces of hardware support to handle protection. And because almost all recent operating systems do that, that's what we're going to talk about extensively, is that model. So one mechanism is what we'll call dual mode operation, that our processors are going to have two modes they can run in. So they'll have some register saying which mode they're in. One mode we'll call kernel mode, and one we'll call user mode. The processor manual might have different names. These are the names we'll use. And some operations are going to require kernel mode. If you try to do them in user mode, they in some way won't work. And the reason that this is useful for protection is the OS can arrange that it decides what code gets to run in kernel mode. The usual way this works is the system boots up in kernel mode, and the system only switches from user to kernel mode at places that the OS specifies as it boots. So because the OS specifies where all the code that starts in kernel mode is, it controls what can happen in kernel mode, hopefully. And this means that these operations, whatever they are going to be things that only the OS is allowed to do. And this might include things like talking to devices, changing what memory is accessible, and things like that, things that are, in some sense, too dangerous to let regular programs do directly. So our second mechanism is address translation, that we need some way of keeping programs from writing over the OS's stuff. This can be the OS's data, like, you know, temporary contents of things from the network or something like that. We don't want programs to manipulate that. This can be the OS's code. We don't want programs to write over that. We also need to keep programs from interfering with each other. So one way you could imagine doing this is that we could like set up a region of memory each program can access. And that's a real thing some hardware has done. But typically, we also want to make it convenient for programs to decide what addresses they use. And so the most common mechanism to implement this type of protection, this memory protection, is address translation, that there's going to be a mapping set by the operating system for each program, and the processor is going to use this mapping. So when program A is running, it's going to use this mapping to figure out when it accesses a particular address, where does it actually go for that? And because the operating system sets this mapping, it can ensure that, for example, program B's data here can't be read by program A, because it just has no address to access it. It can also ensure that the OS's data is not allowed to be read by program A or program B, in this case, this example, by marking it as there's a mapping, but it only works in kernel mode. And on most modern systems, this mapping is going to be stored in a page table, which we'll talk about in a lot more detail in several weeks. Not to say that's the only way you could implement this mapping, but that's what almost all recent machines do. Okay. So questions about dual mode operation or address translation? Generally? Yeah.
I have a question about different applications running like on the CPU. Like, why can't you assign them to two different sets of CPU instead of copying it from like memory into like the same CPU core that you used for the first application?
So the question is, why can't I have the applications, why, if I'm running two applications, why can't I assign them to different cores? So if we have enough cores, we can absolutely do that. So in my example, I had a single core system, but if we had a two core system, then well, with two threads, we could run them on separate cores, but then we'd run into the same problem and use the same solution if we had three applications or four and so on. Yeah?
Does the application talk to page tables directly?
The question is, does application talk to page tables directly? And it depends what you mean by directly. So this mapping is interpreted by the hardware. So the hardware makes it so that when you run a normal looking assembly instruction that like is say move from 1, 2, 3, 4 into RAX. Let's say you run this instruction, which is access memory at, this is a memory address. The hardware is going to put this into the mapping and get it out to figure out where to actually access RAX. And you're going to go through memory to actually get you the value. And that's done automatically by the hardware. So I don't know whether you consider that directly or not, but it's done implicitly and for every single memory access.
So what if you're not writing assembly code? The
question is, what if you're not writing assembly code? Well, your compiler's producing assembly code, you're going to end up in the same situation. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we're going to talk about these two a lot, and we're basically going to assume that they're what you do. But there are real serious operating systems out there and proposals for operating systems which don't use these mechanisms. We're mostly going to gloss over them, but I'm going to mention that they exist so you aren't surprised that they exist. They're even plausibly like could be more efficient, but they're not what's dominant today, so they're not what we're going to talk about much. So I talked about hardware mechanisms for protection. Another thing we're going to need some hardware help for is that the operating system needs to run at some time where there's not an obvious way for it to run. There's events which happen related to managing the hardware, which don't seem to have a way for the operating system to start running. Remember, I told you we're going to take our real core and we're going to load the registers for an actual application on it. That means we have the program counter for the application and the stack pointer for the application. And there's no sign of, for example, the OS code which handles a key press. But we want it to be the case that, let's say, my web browser is drawing pretty pictures, I have my terminal window in front of it, and I press a key. We want the key press to go to that terminal window, and the operating system better do that. But the web browser doesn't have any code that's going to help. It just has code to draw pretty pictures. That's all that's running. So we need some way of running the OS despite that. Or if we have a program using the CPU too long. If I log into, say, one of the depart machines like portal.cs and run my buggy infinite loop, probably we'd like it to be the case that my buggy infinite loop doesn't run forever, keeping anyone else from using that core. And the hardware is going to help out getting the OS to run in these cases. And the mechanism for this is going to be what I'll call exceptions. These also have a whole lot of other names which are kind of related. You might see traps. You might see interrupt. You might see faults. These are sometimes either names for all exceptions or particular kinds of exceptions. I'm going to try to mostly use the word exception. You'll see that XV6 uses the word trap and the word interrupt kind of interchangeably. Uses the word trap because that's what Unix System 6 used, and it uses the word interrupt because that's what the Intel manuals use. We're not going to mostly talk about the types, even though you may see things written down which distinguish between the types. We'll just be, say, an exception that's caused by, or and so on. But these exceptions are hardware support for responding to events. And the key idea is that the hardware is going to take care of figuring out that some event happened, and it's going to run the operating system. And these exceptions have a very important role for our dual mode operation idea. So we're going to have a rule that user code always runs in kernel mode. And I mean always. You might say, what about sudo? What about root? What about administrator? Or system? Or other things you may have heard of? No, there are no exceptions, not even those. It always runs in user mode. So only operating system code can run in kernel mode. And the way we run operating system code is that the exception mechanism, when a hardware detects an event, it's going to switch to kernel mode for us. That's the only way we're going to get switched to kernel mode. And that makes sense for things like a key press because, well, if we need kernel mode to talk to devices like the keyboard anyways, then it makes sense to switch at that time. And typically, this is the only mechanism for doing so. So one thing that this being the only mechanism for doing so brings up is that, well, it seems like we need to go to kernel mode for some other things. So I talked about like events were things outside the program we're running. But there are things that the kernel needs to do on behalf of programs that are going to be requested by the program. So for example, if a program wants to allocate more memory, we need to change that mapping so there's additional addresses in the mapping that work. That's something that the program can't do directly because we wouldn't be protecting the program from other things if we let the program just make any edit to that mapping. So instead, the program's going to have to ask the operating system to decide what's a safe edit to the mapping and have it do it on its behalf. That's going to require running code in kernel mode. If we're reading or writing to a file, let's say it's on a hard drive, the operating system needs to talk to the hard drive. The program's not allowed to do it directly, and that makes sense because if the program talks to the hard drive directly, it could like overwrite files it's not supposed to and things like that that we don't want. For reading input from the keyboard, OS is responsible for doing that, responsible for knowing, if I press a key on the keyboard, which program does it go to, and so on. So all of these need those kernel mode things, need the OS to get involved. So we need to run code in kernel mode when programs want to do this. And I mentioned that the only way we can switch from user mode, which is what our programs are running in, guaranteed, to kernel mode is with an exception. So when programs want to do this, they're going to deliberately trigger an exception. And to support this, hardware is going to provide an instruction whose only purpose is to cause an exception. So it's still going to work like a normal exception. So we're going to use the same code path and same hardware mechanism as for pressing a key. But the cause is not going to be a key press. It's going to be the program ran this special instruction. And then, just like a key press handle, the handler for that will figure out, what does this mean I should do? So let's give an example of what this looks like. And we'll call our deliberately triggered exception a system call, because we're asking the system to like do something on our behalf, kind of like a function call. And in fact, it's going to look kind of like a function call. Like a function call, we're going to have some place where we put arguments. And this is an example of how it might work on 64-bit Linux, where they've chosen that we have RAX, RSI, RDI, R8 and used for our first few arguments. And they have a convention here that they're going to put this constant here. It says syswrite, but it's really an integer constant. I just didn't write out the constant because it makes it readable. So they're going to say, RAX says, I want to do the write operation. And they're going to specify that with this, what we call a system call number in RAX. They're going to specify where do I want to write with a value in RSI, in this case representing standard out. And then they're going to say, here's the data I want to write and here's how long it is. So they're going to set up those argument registers, and then we're going to run that special instruction to trigger an exception. 64-bit x86 has a syscall instruction that does that. And when that syscall instruction runs, the hardware is going to switch to kernel mode. And because Linux, when booting, set a pointer to point to this syscall handler function, it's going to jump there. And that syscall handler is going to be responsible for reading these registers and figuring out what does the program want me to do. And when it finishes doing that, it's going to use another special instruction, this IRET, return from interrupt instruction, to go back to the user code. So we have this user code that runs in user mode, and we have this kernel mode code where we can actually do privileged operations, like whatever we need to do to make the write actually like go to the screen or go to a file, whatever's appropriate. So something to note here is, like with function calls, I put the arguments in particular places, and that's just a decision that Linux made. Because it's just a convention, they decided we're going to use these registers. The only reason we had to use these registers is because we had to be consistent with whatever the code here was expecting. Questions about this idea? Yes?
So it's not possible for a user to trigger an exception himself?
Question, it's not possible for a user to trigger an exception themselves? It absolutely is, because this is an instruction you can put in your program.
But then wouldn't that be like you acting in kernel mode?
So when you, question is, wouldn't that mean that you're acting in kernel mode? So you're indeed causing code to run in kernel mode, but you're causing a particular piece of code that the operating system wrote to run in kernel mode. And that code is only going to do allow you to do things that the OS decided was OK. And if the OS screws up with that, it's a bug. Now, these bugs are kind of frequent, but that's the OS's problem if the OS screws up in writing that handler. Yes?
Would this represent like pressing a button, like a key press or saving to a file?
So the question is, would this represent like pressing a button, writing a key press? No, because when you press a button or and something like that, that doesn't directly execute user code, right? This is the user like asked to printf. Like this is something that printf might do. Or you ask to start reading from the keyboard. This is what you might do to tell the OS, give me a key press when you get it, but the actual key press will be handled later. So this is where the program is running code to request the OS do something. It's not the part where some event outside the program might cause information to get to the program. That's going to be in this kernel code is going to handle that part if that's necessary. This is the request from the program. Yes?
If I try to do something like divide by zero, does it go to kernel mode to fix that, or does it block the user mode?
So the question is, if you try to do something like divide by zero, does it go to kernel mode to fix that? Yeah. So there are exceptions which I do not call deliberately triggered. It's sometimes known as faults, which happen when the processor is asked to do something that doesn't make sense. This is where the name segmentation fault comes from, because that's that kind of operation. In that case, it will start running the operating system, probably at a different handler, but the operating system decides what to do. So with a divide by zero, usually it would go and run an operating system handler for a divide by zero, which probably kills the program, but could do something else. I say usually because I've heard of processors where divide by zero just violently fails. If it's detected as an error, it's going to go to the OS too. And with the same mechanism, but we're going to run a different handler, which will presumably have decided to do something different. Other questions? Okay, so talked about system calls. And in the traditional Unix design, which is what we'll be talking about because it's what XV6 uses, it's what Linux uses, we have our system call interface, which is these operations, like that you saw that write operation, which are implemented by what we call the kernel. The kernel is the stuff that runs in kernel mode. And we also are going to have some libraries, because you don't actually call the write system call directly. Most notably, you would have to write a syscall instruction, and there's no way of doing that in C. Instead, you use libraries that come with the system that are going to contain the code that makes those system calls. And you also have some programs which come with it, like the shell, for example. And some people would say, all this is the OS. Some people would say, only the kernel part's the OS. We're not going to care too much. We're going to talk about a bunch of the stuff up here, though, because it is important regardless of whether it's really part of the OS or not. Okay. So that mind, let's talk a little about XV6 specifically. So our teaching OS based on XV6 is based on 6th edition Unix. Why 6th edition Unix? Because there is a physical book you can buy with the source code to 6th edition Unix. And there was back in the 70s, 80s, when MIT started using this for the OS class, and sometime in the 90s they thought, maybe we should use an OS which doesn't run on the PDP-11, which none of our students have. And so they rewrote it on top of the same basic design on top of x86, and also made it be multi-core because that started to be important in the 90s, and that's what we're using for this class. But it's based on 6th edition Unix, which is very old and pretty simple, which is a good reason to use it, and is a Unix operating system. Our first assignment is going to be adding two system calls to the XV6. So you saw, like, we had a write system call I showed you in Linux. You're going to add something like that for two new operations in XV6. Two very simple things. The assignment includes the download instructions and the XV6 book, and should step you through it. And we're going to talk later today and next time about what does system calls look like in XV6 to make this be a less arduous task for you. So some technical environments. You're going to need a Linux environment. So we have a VM image which works. You can use your own. It's probably possible to do on OS X, but you'll need a cross-compiler. We don't have official support for that, but people have gotten it working in the past. And you'll need QEMU. So we're going to run XV6 in an emulator. The emulator is called QEMU. It's kind of like VirtualBox, but But it's a little more fully featured in some ways. Notably, it lets you theoretically run GDB on XV6, which might be handy at some point. It would not be something you could easily do in VirtualBox. And it's what XV6 is designed to run in. So your first assignment is to get that working. So XV6 has a Unix-like kernel, but with a very small set of system calls. So there's only 25. You might say 25? That's a big number. But if we think of like Linux or Windows, those are more on the hundreds to thousands of system calls. So we're much smaller than that. It has a little user space standard library, but it's very limited. But it's enough to write some real programs. And it comes with some example programs. It comes with a shell, command line, ls, mkdir, echo, cat, etc. And the programs mostly look like what you're used to writing for Linux. I'll show you an example of echo. So echo is a program which you run it, and it outputs its arguments in xsets. So one thing you might notice is first that the header files up here, these header files don't look like the header files you're used to. They're just different because XV6 is its own thing. You might also notice that that printf call doesn't look quite like what you're used to. So XV6's printf takes as its first argument where to print to, and it identifies the output files with a number. One is standard out. We'll learn about more of that probably next week. You also might notice that this main doesn't end with a return, it ends with a call to xset. And that is mandatory here. We can't use return zero. So can someone think of like what would be happening? You know, what might go wrong if we just returned? Why would that like not just work directly? So where should we return to from main, from this main of this echo program? Yeah.
The shell.
To the shell. But the shell is in another process. Remember we talked about the processes being isolated from each other, like so they couldn't access each other's memory, and that's in fact true here. So we can't in fact return directly to the shell. It's not a thing we can do because it's not accessible memory for us. So in order to exit our program, we need to make a system call. And this xset function is implemented in assembly, and the assembly makes a system call. Then I'd say, well, I've never done this on Linux. So what happened on Linux is in Linux, there's some code the compiler provides which calls your main. And when you return to that code, it makes a system call. So Linux has the same situation. On Linux, we have to make a system call to actually exit a program. It's just that the compiler provides code which calls main for you and handles that. XV6 is simpler, doesn't have that sort of library. So in fact, main is where your program starts, and that means that there's nothing to return to. You have to get the operating system involved manually. Okay, so questions? Any questions about our echo code here? So XV6, so you're going to, so you're going to download XV6 with the instructions, you're going to do a git clone and you'll get something like this. You can then build it by running make, which will compile a bunch of things and then run something like make umu nox, nox for non-graphical. There's also a graphical version, but it won't demo as well for my current setup. And that will, there's some extra stuff to compile. And then that starts running. You can see the output of, so here's the command being run to run the emulator, and this is the output of the emulator. And I can run a command like ls, get a directory listing. Not in greatest format, but it's very trying to be very simple. So you have like file sizes in the last column and some other information about the files. I can run the echo command. It works. If you want to quit, one way you can do this is by typing Control A and then X. Another way you can do this, so restarting, is that there's a shutdown command. So that's running it, and we'll have instructions in the assignment for like actually adding things. So that's what you should see to get things working, and I recommend doing that soon so you know if you don't have an environment which can actually run things. Questions on that demo? So, last topic, let's go over how a system call works in XV6 in a lot of detail, since you're going to need to implement it. So, in our user program, we want to make a system call. We're going to use the write operation in XV6. So, we're going to call a write function to call the system call. But the system call isn't actually a normal function call, and it can't be because it has to trigger an exception. A normal function call doesn't do that. So there's going to be a function for us to call from C, and what that function's going to do is it's going to be what we call a system call wrapper. Its only purpose is going to be to convert a function call into a system call. So it's going to include this special instruction that triggers that exception, that deliberate exception. XV6 uses the int instruction for interrupt, because that's what's supported on 32-bit x86. There's no syscall instruction. And it takes a parameter, which is just arbitrarily chosen, we'll see later, and that triggers an exception. When that happens, the hardware is going to look up, based on the kind of exception that was triggered, in a what x86 calls an interrupt table, to figure out where is the OS code that deals with this. And it's going to, once it figures that out, it's going to switch stacks. It's going to change the stack pointer and call an assembly function. In this case, it's an assembly function called vector64. And that assembly function in the XV6 code is going to save registers and then call a C function, because it turns out we want to write most of our operating system code in C, not assembly. And that C function is going to figure out, oh, this is a system call a system call function. And that's going to figure out which system call do we want based on a system call number, because we're going to have one type of exception for all the system calls. So we'll distinguish based on a number stored in EIX, which one it is, and actually call the implementation of the write system call, which in XV6 is in a function called syswrite. And that's going to actually read the arguments and process the write operation. So something you might notice about this is we have this generic trap function, even though we have this specific vector64, like this type of exception function. XV6 has made a choice that they have some common code they want to run for all kinds of exceptions. So even though the hardware supports having separate exception handlers for each type of exception, they don't really use that feature. They just have a little piece of code for each type of exception that calls this common code, which is in the trap function. And that function does some common operations and then figures out what type of trap it was, what type of exception it was, and calls the specific code, in this case, the syscall code. So we have this division, operations, and the purple part here, this is all in user mode, using the user stack, and this yellow part is all done in kernel mode, using a separate stack that's only used by the operating system. So questions about this high-level view of the write system call? So let's look at first the user part. So we can call system calls directly, and this is a typical thing on Unix, is that there's going to be a function in C representing each system call. But it doesn't directly make a system call, because we can't do that like a normal function call. So we have this call to this write function, and the write function is in fact implemented in assembly. So there's this assembly function, and what it does is it first, well, the last thing, the most important thing it does is it runs the special instruction to trigger a deliberate exception. So here, it uses the int instruction with the parameter 64, which is a constant XV6 is chosen for system calls. And also, because XV6 is chosen, it needs to figure out what kind of system call is it. So one option would have been that XV6 could have used different numbers here for each kind of system call. But XV6 decided, no, that's not flexible enough. I want to use my own numbering scheme, not worry about having separate entries in the tables. So XV6 is chosen that they'd store the type of system call it is in the EAX register. That's just the convention. So our wrapper function, this piece of assembly code, going to write that this is a write to EAX, and code later on that we'll see in the kernel is going to read that value back and figure out what to do based on that. We could have chosen any register, we just chose EAX arbitrarily. Now you might say, wait, we have 1, 2, 3 arguments here. Doesn't this assembly code need to do something with them? And the answer happens to be no, because we're going to follow the same calling convention for where the kernel expects to find the arguments as C does. So in 32-bit x86, the rule is that all arguments are stored on the stack. So the kernel code that's going to handle this write operation is going to know to look for the arguments on the stack. It's going to read them from the stack directly. And that's why our assembly code here doesn't need to copy them anywhere or something like that. Okay, so questions about our wrapper function? Yeah?
What's the meaning of the two macros that are sys.ap?
So what are these two macros? So we have to put a number in EAX, and we have to put a number in this special exception triggering instruction. And the operating system decides what the numbers means, and this is just, the macros just indicate which numbers, what meaning those numbers have. So we have to choose numbers, some number to put there. So we chose a number to represent writing versus, say, reading or exiting. So that's what the 16 is. So a different number would indicate exit, for example. And we have to choose a number to represent system calls versus other types of deliberate exceptions that might be exist.
So is it used to look up from the interrupt?
So the question is, it used to look up from the interrupt table? It turns out that this is used to look up in the interrupt table by the hardware. The other one, the right number is not. That's just entirely something that's used by the kernel, by the software. The hardware doesn't know about it. Okay, other questions? Okay, so we have our user mode part. So we have to make so that on boot, the processor knows, well, when that deliberate exception is triggered, I need to run your code, and we need to set that up on boot. And this is the code snippet that does this in XV6. So there's this little piece of code which is run on boot with a bunch of stuff omitted. We have this LIDT function, and this is a function which wraps a privilege instruction known as LIDT for load interrupt descriptor table. And this is an array that the hardware reads, which stores function pointers for every kind of exception, along with some extra information about how they should be called. So this sets where that table is stored, gives a pointer for the hardware to read from. And from that table, the hardware is going to read function pointers. And we set up an entry in this table to point to the function pointer at vectors t syscall, which is the assembly function vector 64. I'll show you what that looks like a little later. It's called vector 64 because it's the 64th entry of the table. So we also set up some other information that x86 cares about for this. So one piece is that we specify explicitly in the table that it's okay for this to be a deliberately triggered exception. So this is why we couldn't just use any number for that. It has to be a number the OS has agreed should be deliberately triggered exception. And we, in x86, you indicate in the table, yes, it's a deliberately triggered exception, allow that. Otherwise, if we didn't set this flag, it would trigger the same type of exception we have for like a divide by zero, that the process did something it wasn't supposed to. We also have to specify explicitly, please run it in kernel mode. You might say, why would it be useful to run exception handlers not in kernel mode? I don't know either, but it's an option in x86. And we specify that we don't want to disable other exceptions, interrupts, during the system call. Meaning that, like, if we have a key press during the system call, we want to still handle the key press right away, even though we're handling a system call. This is a choice XV6 made. It makes writing system calls a little more complicated because, for example, if you're reading from something related to the keyboard, that means you need to make sure it's okay, even though a key press might happen. But it makes things a little easier in that slow system calls aren't going to interfere with things happening promptly. So I mentioned that we set this table entry to point to the vector 64 function. And that's the important part. So when that deliberate exception is triggered, we arrange so the hardware is going to jump to this assembly code, vector 64. And what that does is it pushes two numbers on the stack that we'll read later in the code over here, and then jumps to this ultraps code. It's called ultraps because, in fact, this assembly code is used for every single type of exception. XV6 decided, no, I don't really want separate independent handlers for every type of exception. I really want to do basically the same thing. I'll handle the details later, but the first part's the same. So XV6 is just kind of working around the hardware mechanism because they really wanted basically one handler for most exceptions. And this assembly code sets up a call to a C function. So all this dot, dot, dot code is just computing the argument and making that all work. And then we call this C function called trap. And this is, in fact, the function which is called for all types of exceptions in XV6. And the assembly code is responsible for setting up this trap frame argument, which is going to have the saved registers. So because the C code might change EAX, but we want to know what it was, to know like the system call number. So that's going to be stored in that trap frame data structure. And also the type of exception it was. So later on, we can look up, was this a system call or not, and handle it appropriately. Okay. So questions about this process so far? Yeah?
So when does it use the specific number of the specific exception that's put in the EAX?
When does it use the specific number of the type of system call? Yeah. I'll show you that in a bit. First, we need to use the number that was in the, we need to use this number, the what type of exception it was it, which we've seen, which it turns out, you know, we figured out because we put it here for safekeeping on the stack. And later on, we're going to figure out what it is because we're going to check, was it a system call by checking that number. So that number ends up being stored in trap no. Indicate what type of exception it was. So the first thing our C code does is it looks at that stuff saved by the assembly and figures out, oh, was this a system call? And if so, it first does some bookkeeping. It looks for at the current process. So my proc is a pseudo-global variable, and it returns a struct that gives you information about the currently running process. So the first thing we do is we check, is the current learning process supposed to be killed? Like, was it control steed before the system call happened? And if so, we exit on its behalf. If not, we save the trap frame. Remember, the save registers in that current process is information. And then run this syscall function. And this is where the actual implementation of all the system calls goes to. And it's in this function that we're going to read the EAX value that we're looking for. So in this function, we have a table of functions that implement each type of system call. So this is the syntax for an array of function pointers. I don't expect you to know the syntax for an array of function pointers because it's really ugly, but that's what it is. And this bracket value syntax is basically equivalent to assigning that array element to that value. So the syswrite element of the syscalls data structure is sys underscore write, which is a function. And what the system call handler does is it looks up an array element in that list of system calls and calls it with no arguments. That list of system call implementations. And what index does it use? It reads the value of EAX that was saved previously in the assembly code we saw. So the assembly code copied EAX there. So it reads that old saved version of EAX, looks up the entry for, in this case, syswrite, and figures out it's the write function, so it calls the write function. And after it calls it, it's going to assign the result back to that EAX, and this means that when we return back to the user program, we're not going to restore the EAX that was the write number, the number of the write system call. We're going to store the return value there so we can figure out whether the write was successful or not by reading the EAX register. So then we have our actual write system call implementation. So notice that this function takes no arguments. It doesn't take arguments because, well, we didn't supply any here. No arguments, so the function takes no arguments. But the write system call takes three arguments. Takes what we call a file descriptor, a pointer, and the size of the thing that pointer points to. And we have to retrieve these arguments from somewhere. And we have these utility functions to retrieve them. And what they do is they look at that trap frame data structure, that which has a stack pointer saved in it, and they read it from the user stack. Because that's where they were stored when we called the wrapper function. So this argfd function looks up the file descriptor and copies it into this struct file. We look up the size and copy it into n from argument number 2, 0 base, so that's the third argument. And we get a pointer to that much data into p here. And then we call the actual implementation that handles writing to a file. And I'm not going to show that today. Some questions? Yes.
Why did FC6 decide to do the information retrieval this way instead of just doing a parameter?
So the question is, why did XV6 not decide to, you know, to get the parameters here, right? So one reason is that different system calls take different types of arguments. So if they wanted to do that, they need to have some like table of what are the types of the arguments to do that. So that would be definitely a plausible thing to do. And it would make a lot of sense because we have some common sort of error checking code that you might accidentally forget, which you could put back in there. But yeah, they decided because there's all these different types of arguments, it would be just easier to put it in each system call function. Other questions? Okay, so after this, we have one last step. We're going to return from that syscall function, and then we're going to have to restore all those registers saved in the trap frame because, you know, because we could change them all in the kernel, and then use this special instruction to go back to user mode. So that's where our system call is. And just as a reminder, we had our special number to indicate what type of exception it was, which was used by the hardware here, then used here to decide to call the syscall function. And we had our system call number in EAX, which is used to figure out the call syswrite. And we had our arguments, which were read from the stack. That's where I'll finish today.